Genesis chapter 21, and I'll be reading verses 8 through 21. Genesis 21, verses 8 through 21. So the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, since she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. But God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice. For in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because she is your seed. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar, and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. Then she went and sat down across from him in a distance of about a bow shot. But she said to herself, let me not see the death of the boy. So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, what ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt.
Just to clarify the announcement that was made up about the supper club, I put the list up there with three groupings. We had enough for three groups, which I think is quite the participation. So looking forward to that. And we really know the best way to go from here other than to say, after seeing who's in your group, maybe try, I don't know, after this morning or maybe this evening or maybe by Wednesday to kind of get with them just to make sure everyone's on the same page. And the goal is to have your first supper club in July. And remember, it's just once a month. So for those who signed up, your name should be in one of those groupings. And really looking forward to that. I think it's going to be fun. Most importantly, a lot of good food. Well, maybe not most importantly, but at least, I guess, the fellowship. And I just think it's a great way to build more community, deeper relationships, to get out of these walls here and actually spend time with each other not here, which I think should be the goal. I'm usually pretty poor at selecting a film or a novel to use it as an illustration in a sermon or a Bible class. Because even when someone asks me, what's your favorite movie or what's your favorite book, I usually draw a blank. I just kind of, everything that I've watched or read kind of goes out the window, and I kind of go, well, maybe because I'm just not a big movie critic or I don't, you know, have a sheet ready to go or a selection in the back of my mind. But I struggle with that. And so when I thought about a film or a novel to kind of illustrate the story that I wanted to talk about today, which, as you already know, is about Hagar and Ishmael from Genesis 21, I struggled not just because I always seem to have trouble finding a good illustration, but because it's a difficult story. It's about a serious subject. Something that I think could hit home for probably a lot of us. And to illustrate that, this is a film that really wasn't really talked about that much, and it was kind of looked down upon. If you get like on Rotten Tomatoes or something like that, it didn't really get a good review. But it's actually based on an earlier film and an earlier novel, and that's the novel. And again, sorry about the PowerPoint, because I don't know what's going on, but But for some reason, when you get a newer MacBook, or kind of happen to catch up. I don't know how to get those things to work for more vivid color, but nonetheless, this is a film that I remember watching a time or two, just because it was on TV, and it's really a simple story, but it's a difficult story, because it details domestic violence and abuse. And that's probably the reason why I remember it, but also has Jennifer Lopez, and everyone loves J-Lo, so maybe that's why I remember it too. But anyway, it sticks out to me because of its troubling story. A woman who wakes up one day, having been married for 10 years to who she thinks is just a knight in tiny armor, I guess, and she comes to the stark realization that he's not. He's one who tends towards violence and anger and abuse. And so she has the difficult choice of what to do. And through some difficult decision making and through a lot of ugly stuff, again, watch the film with that in mind, but she charts this difficult journey of leaving her husband with their young daughter and trying to get away and trying to get help. And it's basically all about how is she going to survive on her own when the husband controls bank accounts and things like that. And so it's a real troubling story, difficult film, but it provides for us a glimpse into the life of someone who does suffer through those difficult things. And for that reason, I felt like it was worthy just to kind of mention, because although our story is different on many levels, different in terms of culture, time, place, different characters, and though the story doesn't just explicitly say domestic abuse, but it's kind of implied, at least from how some of the characters behave. And though it's not domestic abuse in the sense, I don't think of like physical violence, but intimidation, fear, and emotional abuse nonetheless. A story filled with the characters of Hagar, her son Ishmael, Abraham, Isaac, and Sarah. And again, though the text doesn't offer a lot of description or commentary and doesn't give a whole lot of details, it offers enough for us to look in and see the emotions, look in and see the anger, see the hurt, see the despair from a mother who is exiled, banished, only with what she can carry on her back and her child into the wilderness. In addition, though, the story manages to give us hope. And like many stories in Scripture, especially the Old Testament, where it is more narrative, this one in particular, like the rest, somehow imagines and creates light and hope out of what seems like a deep, dark crevices of despair. A story about the seemingly hopeless state and unlikely survival of a mother and her son, displaced and homeless, hurt and broken. But first, how did we get here? How did we get from what seemed like a nice family to one where this happened? Well, of course, the book of Genesis is a book filled with a lot of stories about Abraham and his family, really from Genesis 12 onward. It's about Abraham's family. Well, first Abraham and his wife Sarah, but then it becomes about his son Isaac, and then Isaac's son Jacob, and Jacob's 12 sons, including Joseph. And so it's basically just a family story. But when we get to chapter 21, a lot's already happened. The main storyline has emerged, which basically says, since chapter 12, God has called Abraham, this guy from somewhere in Mesopotamia. He worked with other gods. He was really rich, had a lot of stuff. But God called him seemingly out of nowhere and said, hey, I'm bringing you to this new land, this promised land. I'm giving you a new future, a new family. I'm going to make out of you a great nation. And so he does that, Genesis 12. But the struggle is, for Abraham and Sarah and their family, when's it going to happen? It all really revolves around this one issue. which is a pretty big issue because Sarah and Abraham are old, and how's God going to make a great nation out of them when they can't have a kid? But nonetheless, Abraham follows, and remember he journeys, chapter 12, to the land of Canaan. He kind of goes around in circles for a little bit, and so all these different stories, they have to go to Egypt because of a famine. But coming to chapter 16, after God made this promise that you're going to have a child, yes, even though you're 100 and some years old, you're going to have this child. But it never happens. And so Sarah and Abraham think, well, how are we going to make this work? If God's not going to follow through, we're going to have to take it into our own hands. And so they do. After all, Lot wasn't going to fit the bill. Genesis 14 and following, and then the whole Sodom and Gomorrah story in 1920. Some really bad stuff where, well, maybe it was my nephew Lot who's supposed to be my heir. Well, no, that didn't work out. Well, maybe Eleazar of Damascus, who we don't hear a lot about, Genesis 15, 2, maybe he'll be my heir. Well, no, that didn't work out either. But we know how the story goes in chapter 16, where Sarah decides through her cunning devised scheme, I guess, that, well, I have this slave girl named Hagar. She's an Egyptian. And just like it was a cultural practice back then, some culture today, I guess it is too, she decides, well, since I can have a child, I'm going to allow Abraham to procreate with Hagar and have a child that way. And so she does. Hagar and Abraham procreate, but after that, Sarah realizes, well, maybe I made a mistake. And the text says in chapter 16, verse 4, that Hagar conceived. When she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And how she showed contempt, what that really was, I don't really know. But anyway, it drives Sarah crazy. And so she banishes her the first time. Again, we're not even to the second time, in a more serious one. So Hagar leaves. She goes to the wilderness. And there she is in despair. And what am I going to do? And that's where God appears to her, an angel appears to her, and says, your son is going to be named Ishmael, which, just important, remember this, God heard your affliction. That's what the name Ishmael means. And so very significant, because you have this woman in despair who's praying, what am I going to do? And God hears her, literally hears her by giving her this son, through whom he says he'll make another great nation. And so he does, and Hagar goes back, Abraham takes her back, and so the story goes on. But in chapter 21, things get interesting because, well, Abraham and Sarah actually have a son, a biological son that's tied to both of them. And so Sarah conceives, again, I didn't have Rock read this, but you kind of know the story. Abraham circumcises him, as God commanded. Sarah says in verse 6, God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And this is important because, again, the name Isaac, Yitzchak in Hebrew, is the same word that means to laugh, or to make joy, or to play or to joke. And so, Sarah laughs. Well, interesting, that's what Isaac's name means. And so, like a lot of characters in Genesis, you have circumstances which dictate, oh, he's going to be named this way. And whether he's going to be named this way because this is what happens, or it's going to happen, or whether he's named this because this is what happened, whichever order it is, that's what his name is. And he said, verse 7, who would ever have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, yet I have borne him a son in his old age? And so things seem good. This family that God brought from this far-off land to Canaan to make promises, to build a nation, everything seems good. But, like some families, some disordered families, some dysfunctional families, sometimes those things just don't stay together. And so the child grew with wind. Now this is Isaac, verse 8. And Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. And through some ceremonial festival when, I guess, a son or daughter was weaned, which, if I recall, it was like 3 years. So you're weaned at 3 years, and there's some sort of ceremonies that takes place to kind of signify that event. Not unlike, I guess, I don't know, like a Jewish bar mitzvah that signals kind of your transition from boyhood into adulthood if you're a Jew. But that's kind of what's going on. And remember, this is Sarah and Isaac, their backstory, where Sarah laughs because of joy. She's had this child. He's weaned now. He's going to be this promised heir that we can finally have those fulfilled promises that God has promised us. But, verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, slain with her son Isaac. Now, two things. Number one, notice that throughout here, Sarah never refers to Ishmael by his name. It's always that son, the son of that woman, Hagar, the Egyptian. The demonstrative nouns would signify distance between Sarah and Isaac, who they think, well, they're the fine stuff. They're the my son's the heir. And you have Hagar and her son. Well, her son's not good enough. Her son, well, he's second rate. And so the text was on to talk about that. But the other thing is, you go from laughter on the part of Sarah in the first part of the chapter to what's a play again on that same word, Isaac's name, but instead of laughter from Sarah, it's some sort of laughter or playfulness from Hagar's son Ishmael. Again, verse 9. And the text is a little difficult here because in some translations, I don't know about the King James, but I know about the NRSV, that it will say something like it does here, slain with her son Isaac. Although that's not really in the Hebrew text, it's in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation later, and then Jerome's Latin Vulgate. And the Hebrew basically just says that he was laughing. And so you can kind of see how it happens. Sarah is full of joy for her child. But when she sees Hagar's child, the one who, well, technically is the oldest, so, well, shouldn't he get the birthright, and shouldn't he be the one who has the heir, who is the heir and has the possessions and all everything that goes with that? And so she sees him enjoying himself. She sees him laughing. She sees him having a good time with Dad. She sees him enjoying everything that comes with being Abraham's son. And she's disgusted by it. She says, no, this is not going to happen. And so you can kind of imagine that she kind of walks into the den, Abraham's in front of the TV, and she points her finger and gets right in front of the TV so we can't see the football game, and says, you need to fix this. You need to get rid of her and her son because she's ruining everything. Do something about this. And so what was joy, what was laughter at the sight of the son who was promised, turns to anger and jealousy on the part of Sarah. Although Sarah had laughed, she would not let Hagar's son laugh. On the day when it should be joyful over Isaac, it turns to bitterness and despair over Ishmael. And so she commands Abraham, the man with power, to be able to do something like he does, which is drive them out to banish them. Sort of like when God banished Adam and Eve from the garden, or when the Israelites were driven from Egypt, or when the people of Canaan in the books of Joshua and Judges were driven from their land. That same kind of driven, that idea of being cut off, is what's happening to Hagar and her son. The woman that Sarah says, that slave woman and that son of that slave woman, establishing again that distance, that differentiation of status, marking, I'm better than you. I earned it. You are my subordinate. I own you. So a difference in all those ways because that slave woman and that's her son. So Hagar here has already probably enjoyed a life of exploitation. Again, you have to read between the lines. Again, you can imagine a slave girl, what kind of little authority she might have, what kind of a small status she might have. And so exploited already for her labor, yeah, probably. Exploited for reproduction, yeah. Sarah says, hey, reproduce with her. That's kind of what she thinks of her. And so that's what happens. But when it comes time to, after having taken advantage of her, it's time to send her packing with her son. And so
See, again, first of Abraham, verse 10, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac.
Now, this was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son. You know, I'm sure you could imagine. Abraham is very upset. But God says to Abraham, do not be distressed, verse 12, because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you. After the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring. Now, reading this story, I'm kind of put off in a way because it's like, this shouldn't have happened this way. You know, Abraham should have stood up for himself. God should have done something, but that's not what happened. And so, reading this story, again, I don't know how many times, I can't help but read it and be frustrated. Because here the defenseless woman, her defenseless son, and they get the short straw. But even through this, as I hope we can see here in a moment, that God says this but with an eye towards the future, that he will make a great nation even out of Ishmael. He will bless Ishmael and his mother Hagar. So, Abraham decides to go along with it. He arrives at verse 14 early in the morning, takes bread, a skin of water, just what meager supplies they can carry, gives it to Hagar, puts it on her shoulder along with the child, carrying her on her shoulder. I look at this differently when I look at this differently now after being in Cusco through, because when you visit the marketplaces there, you see women who are sometimes middle-aged, but oftentimes even older women, probably, I don't know, 60, 70, carrying children with almost like a blanket or a throw kind of wrapped around them, and that's how they carry the child on their back. So maybe that's kind of what happened here, but because of that, I kind of see it differently. Took the child, took what needed supplies, and went away. And they departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. So here's Hagar, defenseless. Again, what meager supplies she has will eventually run out. No longer wanted around, no longer treated with any respect, she's exiled into the wilderness. And so, like I said, this story is uneasy. Having read it a lot, you have to be angry at Sarah. I mean, why couldn't she have just kept herself in line and not acted out in such a selfish and callous way? But she does. And so as they depart for the wilderness, things get pretty dreary. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way, verse 16, about the distance of a bow shot, where she said, do not let me look on the death of the child. And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. Here, again, a woman without any hope, without any supplies, and she says, well, at least let us both die without having to watch it happen. And so sets her son under a bush under a tree and does what the text says with a bow shot, which I don't know how far the bow shot, maybe it was out of bow, I guess. Well, maybe one of those four bows, but that's about the point. And she does that in misery because she knows that's it. But the story doesn't end there, because even in the midst of this despair and this hopelessness, God provides. Verse 17, and God heard the voice of the boy. Again, Ishmael, his name means God heard, God hears. And so once again, God hears the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make a great nation of him. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. She went, filled the skin with water, and gave the boy a drink. And so God, like he often does, shows up in the circumstances and the places and the situations that we least expect, situations that seem hopeless, situations that seem like there is no way out. And yet, God, like God does so often, protects the orphan, protects the widowed, protects the people who can't defend themselves, protects the people who have nothing other than what's on their back in this world, and yet God shows up to protect them. And this isn't anything new, especially in the book of Genesis, where a major theme is blessing. God blesses certain people for certain reasons. He blesses, again, the Israelites. He blesses Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, in the worst of circumstances. And this continues, again, the theme that starts Genesis 1:1, where God creates out of nothing, giving people out of the crevices, again, of despair and darkness. God provides. God things turns things around. Remember in verse 16, where Hagar and Ishmael are both out apart. Well, notice in verse 20, I think, kind of humorously, fittingly, that God was with the boy. He grew up, lived in the wilderness, and became an expert with the bow. Maybe kind of poetic justice. But God, again, answers the voice of Ishmael. And at that moment, Hagar realizes that she's not alone in the wilderness, that she's not left to survive on her own, to fend for herself and for her child, but God is there. And through grace and through hope, gives Hagar and Ishmael a new future. He'll bless them, he'll make a great nation out of them, he'll give them a new beginning. And how fitting, because Genesis is the book of new beginnings. Whether it's creation, God creating something out of nothing, or creating a new line of descendants out of the whole flood story where everyone's killed and destroyed and the earth flooded and God somehow recreates out of that. And he recreates even out of this situation where it seems like there is no hope or future. Though Hagar feels deserted in the desert, God provides for her and saves her. The Lord sees and hears Hagar, hears her cry, sees her despair. And God, again, will always come to the side of the one who suffers. He always defends them, always protects them. He will hear their cries, see their abuse, see their affliction, because the Lord sees and hears everything. As the Lord heard the cries and pain of Hagar and her son, so he would hear the pains and cries of the Israelites in Egypt. Exodus 2, God heard their groaning. He heard their pain after 400 years of slavery. And so he heard them and brought them out of Egypt. So God also would hear the cries of Jesus on the cross, Hebrews 5, verse 7 and 8, where he is in pain, where he is in anguish, where he needs deliverance. And though Jesus honorably suffered and died, God delivered him and raised him from the dead. And so never really left him, but was there through thick and thin. And so all that points back to Hagar and Ishmael. Though they are in some tough times, God provides. Oftentimes, we get the feeling that in the midst of life, in the midst of whatever difficult circumstance that you find yourself, that God's just not there. But to read a story like this, of a slave woman and her son who are exiled, and to see God show up, I think gives us the perspective that we need, that God will continue to show up even for us today. Now again, the way he shows up is immediately through giving them the provisions they need, water, but also to make them a great nation. And throughout the rest of Genesis and throughout the rest of the Old Testament, you hear of the Ishmaelites, the people descended from Ishmael, and that's really the promise here, that even though Ishmael is technically cut off from the covenant people, Abraham and his people, and that promise, God's still going to make them a great nation. And again, I'm not really well-versed in Middle Eastern history, so who were the Ishmaelites, and who are their descendants, whether it's modern-day Muslims, probably have to draw several family trees to kind of get to them, I don't know. But the point is, God makes a great nation and fulfills his promise, even for Ishmael, even the outsider. Though, again, he's not part of the covenant necessarily, God still blesses him. And so I kind of return to what I started with as we conclude here. And while I didn't craft this sermon necessarily to explicitly address domestic violence, I feel that this text kind of demands that I at least mention it. And so I use that illustration to do that. But also to say this, that domestic violence and abuse in the home and those types of things are prevalent. And I don't really need to give too many statistics to show that whether it's physical violence or emotional violence, those things happen. And the story of Hagar and Ishmael, I think, shows that in a truly substantial way. 20,000 phone calls are placed to domestic violence hotlines on just a typical day. 21 to 60% of victims lose their job due to reasons stemming from abuse. And to give an even fuller picture, 1 in 15 children are exposed to the intimate partner violence each year. 90% of those children are even witnesses to the abuse. More disheartening is that not only is it prevalent, but oftentimes it goes unreported and just not acknowledged. Yes, even in today's world where we think we have a handle on most issues and most problems, and we're so far advanced to people way back then, even Hagar, Ishmael, Isaac, Sarah, we assume that everyone has the same access to those programs and resources that are available for survivors and people who struggle with these issues. And so they're not always ready or able to pick up the phone and call the right hotline. And so many suffer silently and alone. Again, I got these statistics from one of those organizations you find on the web. Again, there are many. But anyone can be a victim of domestic violence because there really is no quote-unquote typical victim. Victims come from all walks of life, various age groups, all backgrounds, all communities, all education levels, all economic levels, all cultures, all ethnicities, all religions, all abilities, and all lifestyles. And so in light of such an epidemic, which, again, affects all of us. If we don't know someone, we know someone who knows someone. And so we see the debilitating consequences of this traumatic event that happens again so often. It happened for Hagar and Ishmael. Though it might have not have been physical, it was certainly emotional. Being exiled, being expelled, being cut off, being sent out in the wilderness to fend for yourself. What might then the story of this house slave used for her reproduction ability at first, and then mistreated, abused, shamed, and expelled, and left to survive on her own, do for women today who have been used, abused, mistreated, shamed, threatened, cut off, if they ever think about leaving? What about those who suffer through decades of abuse, again, with little, if any, support? What can the story of Hagar and Ishmael offer us today? To go a step further, though, what does the story of Hagar offer or demand of us who are not victims, who maybe don't know someone, who are in a position at least to help? What exactly does this text in Genesis 21 challenge us to do today? In view of not only the trouble and the despair and the anguish in the text, but also, again, because of what happens in our society, the physical assault, the intimidation, the behavior, we need to respond. And this, again, isn't an external issue that affects some of the people over there, or some of the people way over there. It affects people here, in this community. I gave statistics nationally, but in West Virginia, 1/3 of homicides are related to domestic violence. Over 12,000 domestic violence offenses were reported to law enforcement in West Virginia just within a calendar year. And a call is placed to West Virginia Hotline every 9 minutes. Over 2/3 of women who were murdered were killed by a family or household member. And so what does this say? What does this challenge us to do? How can we speak out and resist these types of things, these troubling patterns, and how can we help those who are vulnerable? Again, this is a hard and a troubling story, and those are hard and troubling statistics. It's hard and troubling because it happens. It's hard and troubling because we forget about it and tend to do nothing to help. And so, I think today, in our lives, we need to be more aware that people around us suffer. And though maybe it's not just domestic abuse, it could be a lot of things. But I think if we're to say it's one big thing, it's that God calls His people, God calls Christians to stand alongside these people, to suffer with them, and help them. And so may we be the people today and every day who stick our necks out for people who don't have the ability to defend themselves and help themselves. If you need our prayers in this regard or any regard, if you need to talk to one of the elders, I mean, I'm sure they'd be happy to do that. But if you're also here today, outside of Christ, needing new hope, a new future, forgiveness, we'd love to talk with you more about that, to talk to you what it means to be baptized into Christ, to be forgiven, to be a Christian. And if we do that now, do that later today. We'd love to do that as we stand and sing this song together.